Our 19th Stop the Violence, Start the Healing campaign continues, and this is our panel discussion dealing with this week's topic of sexualized violence in Humboldt County. And we've got a great group of guests here in the studio. We'll start off with my co-host for the past 19 years, Sherry Johnson. Say hi.
Hello.
Hello there.
Hello, listening audience.
So, again, give folks your credentials, your background.
I am the co-host for the past 19 years of the Stop the Violence, Start the Healing radio education campaign. I'm also the chair of the Humboldt County Domestic Violence Coordinating Council, and I'm the director of field education in the Department of Social Work at Humboldt State University.
Indeed.
To my left.
My name is Kim Schneider, and I am the advocate for the District Attorney Victim Witness Office assigned to the Child Abuse Services Team.
Fantastic.
And hi, Susan. I'm Susan McGee, and this month, November, I am celebrating 35 years since I started work in a shelter in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And this is my life work to fight against violence against anybody in an intimate relationship or who's been victimized and a victim of sexualized violence. I'm happy to be here, Cliff.
Mm-hmm. Mary Ann Hayes Mariani with the North Coast Rape Crisis Team. Happy to be here as well.
Wonderful.
And you're a repeat guest as well.
Yes.
Oh, sure.
Yes. You've been very hospitable to our issues.
Thank you, everybody, making the trip down here and being here with us today. This is a very difficult topic. We should just say that right from the start. It's very hard to talk about sexualized violence and to just acknowledge right from the start that there might be people like, I was waiting for the Friday morning funnies. This is not funny. So we will take the next 2 hours to just have a conversation about surviving and about some information about sexualized violence. So if you're a loved one of somebody who's a survivor, you're a survivor yourself, this is a conversation where we're going to just be able to talk about things as they really are. So.
And one thing I'd like to bring up, and this is something Amy mentioned, and it was like, you're right, I actually do need to mention this, is that we are going to be dealing with some subjects that someone who may have gone through something like this, it may be too much for them.
Yes. Yeah,
so just a warning to you that we are going to be going pretty deep into this topic. And for some of you, the wounds may be too fresh, or it may be just too much. And we would, for you, I would encourage you to tune out. For some, this could be a very healing thing to be able to hear others talking about something that maybe you thought was just you, that you were going through, to know that there is help out there, and to know that there are others who have gone through similar things.
There will be phone numbers given throughout the show. There's also on the website a resource guide, both in English and in Espanol. So really, if this conversation prompts you to make a phone call, then that would be a really wonderful thing. Also, maybe little children's. They might not, unless you've had conversations with them about some of these subjects. Might not be a good thing for little kids.
Absolutely.
So, anyway, I think people want to know what sexualized violence. What do we mean by that? I mean, that's not a, I think people are familiar with other terms, but I don't know that they're familiar so much with this term. So, Mary Ann, maybe you could help us understand why we use that term.
Sure. And I really appreciate both you and Cliff mentioning that survivors might have different reactions to the information that we're having, and that we all be supportive as a community, that there's not a right or a wrong way to heal from sexualized violence, and that it's very individual and unique to the person. So sexualized violence is really wrapped all around consent for someone with the age of consent for any kind of sexual contact. And I know our name is the North Coast Rape Crisis Team. We keep that name because rape is a really hard fact of our rape cultural world. And so it's harsh reality. But we serve all survivors of any kind of sexualized violence. So any kind of sexual activity that is not consensual is sexualized violence. It takes many forms. And for children, it's any kind of sexual contact, irregardless of if the predator is trying to pretend that there's some kind of consent involved, because they don't have enough life experience and information to be able to provide consent. So,
and while you opened that door, it reminded me, we have a good friend of the campaign who brought something up and decided that it was just too emotional for her to actually come on and talk about this. But it seemed like this is the forum for us to talk about that. And she was there was a story several weeks back in the Lost Coast Outpost about child pornography here in Ferndale, and she mentioned the fact that, you know, the whole term child pornography is almost kind of soft peddling.
It is
what this
soft-peddling
is.
It, yes,
because, you know, when we think of pornography, you know, this is, you know, is you know something that adults use for pleasure, and this is kind of it kind of soft pedals what's happening with when children are involved. This is absolute sexual exploitation.
Absolutely.
Well, it's beyond, I think sexual exploitation is still soft peddling it.
That, okay, you're
when
right.
When we're talking about child pornography, we are talking about child rape. We are talking about people viewing the rape of children.
Mm-hmm.
And by viewing it, they have become complicit. And most of those people who are looking at child rape on their computers, or they're trading it with other people, most of them are child rapists themselves. And I use that term, and I want to be inclusive, because it's you know, not necessarily penetration. It's you know, can be touching inappropriately. It can be touching the genitals in without consent. But we had quite a controversy in the LGBTQ community 3 or 4 years ago about a man who is now in prison for child pornography. And a number of people said, well, we can't judge him. We can't, you know, make any comments about what he's been doing. And I said, well, I'm sorry. Everybody's innocent until proven guilty. But his computer has just been seized. There has been major, you know, and we need to know that this is part of the continuum of sexual abuse. This is not a victimless crime.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. And this is why we wanted to bring this up, you know, right now, because this is you know, soft peddling something as vile as that is, you know, is something we should not be doing as a community. You know, people, I think, in general are, you know, their reaction is pretty strong to child pornography, but that label does make it seem a little bit more innocent than it really is.
Than the reality of trafficking, than the reality of
mm-hmm.
buying children and... It's unspeakable.
Yes.
But we must speak about it.
Yeah.
And yet it's so common.
Yes.
That's the other thing.
Yes.
And our silence about it promotes that tolerance. And that's why I really greatly benefit each year you all being willing to speak about something that is so taboo in our culture. And that really promotes the rape culture that we have. And each time we speak and promote dialogue about it, we're chipping away at that rape culture.
Every time somebody resists, they create a space for resistance around them. Every time someone speaks out, they make more space for people to break the silence. And we still have a tremendous amount of silence, particularly about the sexual aspects of abuse. It is much harder for people to speak about it. It's much harder for people to disclose. There is still more shame and stigma. And I believe that's because sexuality is sacred. My personal belief is that the body is sacred, sexuality is sacred, and by acting without any individual's consent, you are committing an act against nature, against good, against what I believe is you know, the beauty and joy of consensual sexuality.
And speaking of consensual sex, there cannot be consensual sex when we're dealing with children.
No.
Right, exactly. Exactly. They don't have the life experience and knowledge to be able to get consent. And that's why our laws clearly state that, you know. And I think, again, when we're dealing with youth, many of them don't have the life experience. And then they've got predators of older adult people in their late 20s and 30s being a predator towards them, targeting them. And with their lack of experience of engaging in that kind of relationship, they're very vulnerable to that kind of approach. And then sometimes you hear a lot of people in our community say, well, she or he looked of age or acted of age. And yet my experience has been the moment that youth engages in conversation, they may have all of they may be very well developed physically as an adult, but you know that you're engaging with a youth. When you're having a conversation with somebody, there's some developmental aspects of their engagement that let you know that. And mm-hmm. so that whole defense of, well, they said they were this age, I thought they were this age, they looked this age, to me, there is no defense, because the predators are very astute and sophisticated in that way, and they know what they're dealing with, and they know how they can manipulate and coerce someone.
Really, and the reality is that all rapists and batterers and all abusers are targeting people. They're planning their abuse. They are not – it is not impulsive. They're not just getting into a bad situation where things get out of control.
Mm-hmm.
This is not about it's about – which is the horrible thing, you know, to really realize in your gut about this issue, is that it's not impulsive. It's not, you know, it's somebody who is deliberately targeting people. And that's why we have, the research tells us, our experience tells us, that there's a huge crisis of sexual exploitation and domestic violence and dating violence among, you know, youth 18 to 24, among all children. It's the most common type of, you know, sexual abuse. It's horrible.
Well, I really appreciate the mention of softening of language. I think that especially when we're talking about youth, we're talking about individuals that don't have that life experience. And so as adults, we can take into consideration why somebody might soften that language or minimize that language, mm-hmm. and really still own what's happened to us as a survivor or as a support to a survivor. But if we're working with youth and we're dealing with children who have experienced this level of victimization or exploitation, they don't have the ability to conceptualize that. And so we need to be really careful about the language that we use and name the things that have happened so as to not minimize what's happened to them.
We also have to understand that it's a question of the developing brain. That, you know, even in adolescence, the brain is still developing. And it's a developmental issue. But, you know, in some ways, a 14-year-old, you know, these days, in particular because of the internet, may sound sophisticated,
mm-hmm.
May look sophisticated, but their brain is still developing. They're still in a developmental place, as you both said, that they're not able to consent, you know, and they are targeted. The most common thing is being targeted by 25-year-olds. The most common thing is 25-year-old men targeting 15-year-old girls. You know, that's the reality. You know, and folks can say more about that, but that's my experience. And of course, that does not mean that there are not boys and, you know, who are also victimized. That is another hidden situation. You know, mm-hmm. it's still a stigma. You know, for boys, more of a stigma, because, you know, it goes against our societal conditioning that men are not supposed to have this happen to them, and they're supposed to take care of themselves, and, you know, and they're supposed to be tough, and they're not supposed to disclose, and, you know, we're still dealing with all that 20th century stuff.
Right, and always enjoy sex. Never
yeah.
ever be
right.
able to to say no, that they would not welcome that kind of activity.
Wonderful Glee X episode that my daughter, 15-year-old daughter, just showed me about that, about a boy who was 16 and, you know, finally disclosed that he had been a survivor of child rape, and, you know, everybody, you know, was like, well, what do you mean? You didn't love it? I mean, it was a very good episode. I recommend it.
And I think it calls into question the status of children, and mm-hmm. that many adults really still consider children to be property,
mm-hmm.
and parents their property, and that they are just like sort of little objects that you can do things to and to. And then
it really also calls into question, what is it like for the child who then survives that? Because, you know, children are sexual beings.
Yeah.
You know, you're sexual being all the way from the very start to the very end. So what happens to our sexuality when we're survivors of child abuse, child sexual abuse?
It gets confusing. It gets really confusing. And especially like we were all talking about earlier, when we don't talk about sex, we promote it, we exploit it, we do all kinds of things with it, but we don't genuinely talk about it. And even when we're in the classrooms and trying to have these conversations with the youth about this, they're like, oh, we're really going to talk about this. Yeah, we really want to promote having a dialogue so you have a sense of what feels comfortable for you, what is your boundary around that, you know, what are your values around that, because without that, people... it's just too confusing. If they're not knowing what's, like we've had many survivors say, if there is sexual abuse really young, often by someone that they know and love, it gets confusing because what the predator is telling them about, this is how you express love. This is my special plot, relationship with you. And when a child isn't having enough information to discern that, they're trusting their adult to give them the right information. Mm-hmm. So it gets really confusing. And then when they're coming of age and trying to explore their sexuality, that all gets impacted with that.
Right. Marianne, you bring up a good point. And because we talked a lot about, you know, the exploitation of children with the child pornography and whatnot. Now we're moving into what is even much more common, which is the very trusted person who violates that trust. Mm-hmm. And I want to explore that a little bit more, but we've got to take a quick break. But we'll continue on that topic in just a moment. And I would like to remind folks that this is an open community dialogue. You are certainly welcome to join in. Ask a question. Well, we have this wonderful panel of guests here. Ask questions, make a comment, share a story, whatever you would like to do. You don't have to give your name. 786-KHUM, that's 786-5486. It's 22 minutes after 8. This is KHUM, and we continue our Stop the Violence, Start the Healing campaign. Sexualized violence is what we're looking at. Sexualized violence here in Humboldt County. And we were earlier talking about child pornography and the fact that that really is soft-peddling, really the heinous crime that it is. And we just started touching on something that is unfortunately much more common, and that is the violation of trust of someone that a child knows very well. It could be a friend, it could be a family member, and
could be a coach, could be a coach. Any adult that the child comes in contact with, a neighbor. And Susan, before you go on your little thing there, I want to say that oftentimes what will be said by that person is, you know, you're going to have sexual activity and I want to introduce you to sexual activity mm-hmm. in a loving way.
Mm-hmm.
So that mm-hmm. can be extremely confusing, and it can be confusing because if as you're groomed, you know, it may even feel good because mm-hmm. of the feelings that are generated by certain parts of our body. So that gets confusing. So we're in an area here where, you know, if you've never had an opportunity to really think about this or talk about this, that's what we're going to do. So, Susan.
Well, I want to go back to what you said, Sherry, mm-hmm. about children being property. That we still view children as property. And it's an antiquated idea, which is too often still in practice. When I was thinking about this last night, though, I wanted to share that we also still see women as property. That it was not until 1993 that all 50 states in the United States made rape in marriage a crime.
93?
1993. Mm-hmm. I just looked at the research. It's sitting right in front of me.
That's astounding.
And this concept goes back to Lord Matthew Hale in the British common law that says you can't rape your wife because she's a part of you. Mm-hmm. That's where it comes from, and he was a witch burner. This is how antiquated some of our ideas are. But you can see in 1993 was the last time, and there's still exceptions to, there are still exceptions that, well, if you're your wife and in some states and, you know, and she's asleep, you know, maybe that's not a crime. That's in the law in some states. I'll leave you the research. But I just, before I left, I just wanted to get to that because I was so outraged last night because I hadn't looked at it in a while. I'm like, that's true? Oh my gosh. That's awful because when I, when we were changing the, in 1985, we were working on changing getting marital rape a crime in Michigan, and we finally got it in 1987. And I thought, you know, everybody else was pretty much done with it by then. But I was wrong.
Wow.
And I remember a survivor coming to our center in the early 90s, and she was speaking of that. They were having, she was in a course at HSU, and the professor was naming and wanting the class to rate the different violent aspects, and one of it was raping a wife. And the women all marked that rating it from 1 to 10, 10 being the highest and hideous of a crime. Most of the women in the classroom rated it as 10, and most of the men rated it as like 1 or 2.
Wow.
And so some of the women spoke up, and it was a male professor, and was outraged at the survey and how the men had responded. And the professor said, well, sometimes, you know, that's just recently passed as a law, and it takes society a while to catch up with, you know, the impact of that law. And it's just, again, one of the ways
years.
Of our rape culture and minimizing that, you know, we it's okay for us to be outraged about that and have a conversation about that and not sweep it under the rug or just minimize it again, continually minimize it. So I appreciate you mentioning that.
Yeah, absolutely. So do I. And working with survivors of domestic violence, so many times there was no mention made of sexualized violence until that conversation was broached and the discussion about whether or not there was the threat of harm or intimidation if they didn't consent. That is that really consent? No, that's not consent because
it's
there
coercion.
Is the threat. Exactly. And a lot of times we would have a discussion about, well, what ends an abusive incident when we're talking about safety planning and how do we engage in removing ourselves safely from a situation or a relationship? And many, many times, well, we'll engage in some kind of sexual activity to end that altercation, whether it be a physical altercation, an emotional altercation. And then we go into this discussion, and so many survivors, and most of the survivors I'm talking about are female for this particular, you know, caveat, but didn't acknowledge that that was a form of sexualized violence, that was rape, that there was coercion, and that there was a threat of physical harm or emotional harm if they didn't engage.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because we hear still, to this day, so many survivors, and I think it often comes from that grooming as a youth about not having rights around things, that, well, that's an expectation. I'm in a relationship. Even if there isn't a marriage contract, they're in a relationship, and that's an expectation of the relationship. So then I guess it is consensual, but trying to have to reframe all that and redefine
it. And as Paula said in her interview this week about this, is that she doesn't recall in the marriage vows where it says you sign on to have sex when you don't want to.
Right.
So, but there's this implicit understanding that, you know, that's why you're married.
And batterers and rapists use the rape culture. How many times have I heard from a survivor, well, he told me he had to have sex because, you know, we're married and that's, you know, what married people do. And it was you need to be a good wife and you need to put out when I tell you to. And, you know, there's also the aspect of what's, you know, now colloquially called makeup sex. But, you know, it's very, very common that a batterer physically, brutally assaults his partner and then says, well, you know, now we have to make up. And now we're going to have sex. And of course, she's feeling desperate.
Violated again.
And, but, you know, maybe going along with it will prevent tonight another assault. I mean, it's very deep.
We should also mention that not all domestic violence involves actual physical violence. There are plenty of people who have been very abused and don't show any physical scars, no bruises on them. Yet the coercion is still there. The threat may be still there. You know, and it's still violence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did expert testimony in a murder case at one point, and the murderer had controlled his wife by using withholding medication, withholding her insulin. She was a type 2 diabetic, and controlled her by those means, and he never struck her, mm-hmm. but he effectively controlled her before he murdered her. And he was convicted of first-degree murder. And particularly the subtle, I've had experience with subtle upper-class, rich batterers who, you know, can control through, you know, they don't have to hit their partner. They have the economic means. It's all verbal abuse. It's all psychological terrorism. It's all, you know, and never has to raise their fist. Or there's one assault, and the batterer can make reference to an assault if you know what will happen. If right. you try that again, you know what will happen.
Yeah. I appreciate you mentioning that, Cliff, because I think that is the misconception out there, that in sexualized violence and domestic violence, it's lots of physical brutality. And there are other forms of brutality. And most of the situations that we deal with within sexualized violence is not extreme physical battering, but there's drug-facilitated sexual assault, which is really common. We're a very medicated culture, mm-hmm. and so people start out really young exploring the different alcohol and other drugs that are out there, and predators pay attention to that. And I remember my son was an adult now, but he was out there, and he was a young adult at the time, and he was out in the Arcata at the square, and I think it was, you know, some partying thing, either Halloween or New Year's Eve or something like that. And he's calling me. He says, "Mom, there's some guy out here, and he's handing pills to really drunk young women."
Wow.
And whoa. I call him on it, but then he moves to the next bar. You know, there's the line of bars, the block. He goes, "I don't know what to do." And I go, "Well, is law enforcement around?" And he goes, "Yeah, but everybody's going to call me a snitch or whatever." And I go, "You're seeing something happen right now that's really dangerous. And you're right on. It is really dangerous. He's being a predator, and he's looking to give this and then follow that girl somewhere or whatever." Yeah. And so eventually he did call law enforcement in on it, and a group of people called him a snitch and everything like that. But that's the kind of thing that we really do need to pay attention to as a culture. When we see something happening, ask somebody if they need help. You know, that's that victim blame thing. Well, if they were under the influence, we have so many survivors, all genders, all ages, saying, you know, I shouldn't have, could have, would have done this, and then this wouldn't happen. Mm-hmm. And if somebody's under the influence, that isn't the healthiest thing, but who of us gets through life without making those kinds of mistakes? And what would I do for a friend that's under that situation? Help them get to mm-hmm. a safe place and be well and be okay,
yeah.
not to target them.
And
you know?
What needs to be said is that if someone who is under the influence lacks the ability to give consent.
Exactly.
And so what I say to men when I'm, you know, not being particularly diplomatic and doing training is I say, okay, so you go to your buddy's house and you have, you have 2 six-packs or you have part of a keg and you get pretty drunk, and then he anally rapes you. Is that okay? And there's a big sigh in the room like, oh, I guess not. I said, well, then what's the difference? You know, when you're blaming a woman because she's impaired or intoxicated for the assault that is committed against her. And I'm sorry, I'm glad you told the children not to listen to this part, because it can get pretty intense for me.
But it needs to be said.
Mm-hmm.
I know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's an important discussion to talk about the stigmas that go along with gender and what it means to be sexually assaulted and what we believe as a society about sexual assault, and that men can be sexually assaulted. And it's always a difficult conversation, especially having that with my peers. Like you had mentioned, discussions about boys that have been sexually assaulted, and that, well, men are always supposed to want to have sex, right? That's the expectation of men in our society, that they are sexual beings, mm-hmm. and that any sexual encounter is a positive one. And I've had many different conversations where I've just been sitting and listening, and my partner's always like, put your soapbox away. Like, please don't embarrass me in front of my friends.
Yeah, I've heard that too.
but discussions about, you know, somebody that they knew in high school or somebody that they met when they were in college about how their first sexual encounter was with an adult female, somebody that was much older in a position of power. And I'm standing there like jumping up and down. That's sexual assault.
That is.
They didn't have the ability to give consent. They're a child and this is an adult. But the attitude amongst these men discussing it is that, well, that's okay, right? Because men want to have sex.
But rape is never okay.
Exactly.
And I wince and I get on my soapbox when I hear people say, oh, good, that sex offender is going to go to prison and be raped. I'm like, no, that is wrong. It is never okay to violate another human being. And by the way, it's a myth. It's the trans people and, gay men who look what is perceived as a stereotype of gay who are the ones who get raped in prison. You know, so the whole thing is, you know, and people are like, oh, yeah, kill him, throw him away. It's like, no, they're still valuable human beings no matter what they've done, and no one ever deserves to be raped. Now, I'm on my soapbox. I may never get off. Let me be on it for the rest of my life.
That's why you're here.
Yes.
We appreciate that. There is lots more for us to deal with on this topic. We've just got it started. We're going until 10. And again, if you would like to join in on this conversation, make a comment, ask a question, share a story, 786-KHUM at 786-5486. It's our 19th Stop the Violence, Start the Healing campaign. And we will continue right after these quick words. 38 minutes after 8 o'clock, you've got it on KHUM. It's our Stop the Violence, Start the Healing campaign. And we are in the midst of a two-hour roundtable discussion dealing with sexualized violence in Humboldt County. If you were just tuning in, it's a pretty intense topic. And I gave this warning a little bit earlier. I'm going to give it again. Anyone who has gone through something like this and finds this topic a little bit too uncomfortable, we encourage you actually to tune out. However, some of you may benefit from hearing a very good group of experts talking, knowing that you're not alone in some of the experiences that you may have gone through. So we leave it up to you, and we also leave this up to whether or not you find it appropriate for your children. I, for one, let my children learn about all this stuff because I think it's important for them to know. But
it's a parent's choice.
It's a parent's choice, and you make that decision what you think is more appropriate for your children.
And I think it's really helpful for us to have Marianne give the phone number for the North Coast Rape Crisis Team.
Absolutely,
because I know that anybody can call.
So the number is 707-445-2881. And that's available for survivors and their loved ones to call and receive support and information every minute of every day.
And we want to acknowledge Susan McGee, who had to leave the discussion because she's got some.
She's headed to Humboldt State University for a sexual assault prevention committee meeting.
Busy person. And we really appreciate her coming down to the time that we could even have with her.
Right. Because as advertised, Mary Beth Bion was supposed to, from Victim Witness Assistance Program, and then Kim let us know that she's in Oakland still. So
it's a little hard to get here.
Yeah, yeah. So Susan kind of filled in at the last moment, and we really appreciate it.
So one of the things that one of you mentioned, and I think it was Susan who talked about, is it okay if we have a six pack and I anally rape you? And that was like, wow. But it did open the door to, something that was in the news fairly recently, and that was the quote-unquote hazing of that football team, the high school football team, which wasn't really hazing. It was sexual assault. It was rape.
Right.
It was the raping of, and this was an initiation that the players would actually be raped. Absolutely remarkable.
And until this one person spoke up, we have no idea how long that particular ritual had been going on, because secrecy was part of the deal.
Absolutely. And the amazing thing is, as heinous as this was, still blowback from the community saying, hey, come on, this is a ritual. This is a hazing. This is, you know,
and I
initiation.
Think that's a lot of our culture too, because that's part of sometimes the gender role stereotypes that we have in our communities of males, like you were saying, Kim, they're supposed to be the ever-ready battery, always ready for sex, but also they're not allowed to be victims of anything in any way. So if something was hazing, then a lot of the community might come from the place of, yeah, you participated in it, you wanted it, you were, you know, rather than acknowledging that that person was overpowered and vulnerable. And the same for females, it's on the flip side of things. It's almost like a conditioning that you will be victimized and you have to learn how to deal with it. And so trying to fight through all that to figure out your way of healing is really, really challenging. And that's why it's really important that somebody does find their voice and comes out and says it. And then that sometimes assists other survivors in finding their voice about and naming the truth of what happened to them. Because that, I think, is the most impact on any kind of healing, is when the survivor is so challenged by their support system to even name the truth of what happened to them.
Absolutely. And I think we go back to that softening of language again. This is just a hazing. This is just a ritual. This is just kids will be kids or boys will be boys kind of attitude, as opposed to, no, that's rape. The word rape makes us uncomfortable. Overall, you bring up the word rape and it stops a conversation. Whereas if you say that was just a hazing, just something that happened, it's more comfortable for people to talk about. It's easier for us to deal with it. Just in general. And I appreciate your mention of the expectation that women will be, or females will be, sexually assaulted. And then it becomes their responsibility to prevent that or figure out a way for that to no longer happen. How do we as women prevent people from sexually assaulting us? You go with your buddy, you have the buddy system, or you don't drink, or somehow you're responsible for what happened or what could potentially happen.
Exactly. And don't walk by yourself. You don't, you know, go out at night. You always have somebody with you. I mean, all of those things.
Yeah, the interesting thing with what you're talking about is, you know, that is a cultural thing. We talked last week about that video that YouTube video that went viral of the woman who walked around New York, and you know, you get to see her getting hit on constantly. And then the flip side of that, the same thing was done. Where was that, in Australia, New Zealand?
Australia,
yeah. And it was unbelievably less. I mean, it was very rare. And again, that was a cultural thing. But you know, the thing where you're talking about where it's up to the women to prevent the sexual assault. You know, if you look at certain cultures, with even more extreme, there are many parts of the world where women have to dress in a burqa because to show any skin is provoking sexual assault. It's opening the door to it, and it's up to you as a woman to not show anything. Which, you know, again, it's shifting the responsibility. You know, it's like, you know, men do not have, I mean, we are not like, we're not like, we can control urges. we are not just, you know, like, woman must have, you know, it doesn't work that way, but it's cultural, you know, and it's something that we can unlearn as a culture, and really should. This is, you know, the fact that women have to worry about being hit on constantly, being, you know, walking around in this country, is just ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous.
And that's the thing that I think happens, too, is, like, we don't talk about the consensual sex stuff a lot, but then even for really young people, they're immediately sexually exploited. I mean, you can't find clothing for little girls that don't label and exploit them in some way. You know, it's really challenging in that way. So that sets the conditioning. And unless we start and continue to have these dialogues and trying to unravel that, we're not going to change anything, because we need to get on the soapboxes, maybe get shunned by some of our social community, but really keep standing up and speaking the truth of the matter, so that it is, because otherwise it's still really challenging for survivors of any gender, of any age, to come forward and say, this happened to me. That's really hard, because they get shunned by their community. People don't want to believe that somebody next door that they knew, that they were a friend of, that they were acquainted with, that they do business with, could do this, that they would have somebody like that in their life. And so they rather believe that the youth, the child, the adult is making it up in some way, you know. And I think unless we keep having these discussions, those kind of misconceptions are going to flourish.
And perpetrators are really good at outlining the potential repercussions of coming forward mm-hmm. that are the reality, that somebody might not believe you or they won't believe you. This is going to cause difficulties for your family. People at school won't like you as much anymore. And so a youth comes forward and they, or even an adult survivor comes forward, and then they see that all of the things that the abuser had mm-hmm. been telling them was going to happen is starting to happen. Mm-hmm. And now we start to backpedal. Okay, they were right. These people don't believe me. These people aren't going to accept me, etc. And it all becomes a reality for them.
We started the first week of the campaign with the culture of aggression, and I think we did so intentionally, so that as we proceeded on in the campaign, you would see that these acts that happen on a ubiquitous, seemingly to appear everywhere at once basis are based on cultural assumptions. And that the culture is, the training of that culture is that aggression is appropriate. Mm-hmm. You can meet your needs, and if you can meet your needs, that's okay. And that there are winners and there are losers. And so those of us who have been victimized, those of us who are survivors, we just didn't win in that particular circumstance. And based on gender, based on class, based on age, based on all of those things that make us celebratingly different, become our vulnerabilities. Mm-hmm. And if you're vulnerable and weak, you can be preyed on. And we have an economic system that is based on predatory exploitation.
Yeah, one thing that you mentioned, Kim, was the fact that, you know, the story's coming out and people are believing it. And there are reasons for stories not being believed, based on the way people deal with trauma. Mm-hmm. And I've got some little clips of video. We'll obviously just hear the audio. That this was put together for law enforcement in dealing with trauma victims. You know, people who were sexually assaulted, and actually what happens in the you know how memories are laid down and which chemicals get flooded into the body. I'd like to play one clip. If you want to put your headphones on, we can listen to the first one right now. Let me just bring this thing up here, and we can respond to it.
So during a traumatic situation, there are two basic neurobiological processes that we're interested in looking at. One is what hormones are released and how does that affect behavior during the assault and the immediate aftermath of the assault, and then what is happening with respect to the memory of that traumatic event. Most survivors are going to have one of four main stress chemicals released in their bodies, or some have multiple hormones and chemicals released at the time of the assault, one of which are going to be the catecholamines. Catecholamines are like natural adrenaline. It's what pumps your body up in a traumatic or stressful situation that would help a survivor be able to fight back against the attacker or try to flee from the situation. Another hormone that's often released for survivors during an assault are the corticosteroids, and those work in conjunction with the catecholamines to determine how much energy is available. So again, for some survivors, they have a lot of energy available to fight back and to flee, and they stay very pumped up after the assault. But some don't. It sort of bottoms out and flattens out on them, and they might freeze during the assault, or they might be in kind of a stupor almost after the assault. Other hormones that affect the behavior at the time of the assault are opiates, which is like natural morphine. So some survivors during the assault report feeling like they're almost drugged, that they're out of it, and then when they do first responder interviews later, they have no affect. They're just describing it with no emotion, no affect, you know, like they're reading out of the TV guide. There's just nothing to them. That's the opiates. The opiates help block physical pain, which you need during a traumatic situation, but they also just keep blunting everything. Okay. The other hormone that's sometimes released is oxytocin, and this is a hormone that promotes good feelings. Okay, and that may sound strange. Why would you have a hormone that's about good feelings released during a sexual assault? Again, it's about trying to block the pain, the physical pain, the psychological pain. So the body will release opiates, natural morphine, to try to tamp down the physical pain, and sometimes it will release oxytocin in conjunction with that to try to balance it out. Hormone that promotes good feelings, hormone that tries to blunt pain. Again, it's just trying to mitigate the pain of this assault. But if the oxytocin levels get a little high, sometimes survivors might laugh, giggle, smile, engage in socially appropriate behavior that's socially inappropriate given that situation.
So, the thing is, these are the physical chemicals that can be released during, or that are released during, different assaults and traumas like this. And the next piece of audio deals with how it deals with recall, which can really cause problems. And that's why they actually made this training video for law enforcement to how to react to what certain victims of violence are saying. And we can play that in a bit. First, we're going to hear these quick words. All right, we're 4 minutes away from 9 o'clock. You've got it on KHUM, and it's our 19th Stop the Violence, Start the Healing campaign. We are dealing with sexualized violence here in Humboldt County, and we were just talking about the effects of trauma physiologically on what chemicals are flooded into the brain and whatnot. I was not sexually assaulted, but I was assaulted in an accident, and I can tell you that there are memories that just completely are gone. You know, it's like, how could you have forgotten something like that? It never got implanted, and I have no memory of certain things. I remember being hit, and then I remember being on the freeway, but I don't remember anything in between. That is just completely gone. The next clip deals with these chemicals and how they affect recall and the problems that it can also create when being interrogated by law enforcement.
So those are the four hormones that can affect the behavior during the assault. And these hormones are really instrumental in blocking the physical pain, helping the body react to the trauma of the assault. Now here's the kicker. Those four hormones, very helpful in so many ways. When those four hormone levels are very high in the body, it interferes with other structures in your brain that are trying to lay down the neural mechanisms of the memory. So it's one of those times where our body's kind of working at cross purposes. Those hormones are really helpful for fight, for flight, for mitigating the pain, but they cause cellular damage in two key structures of our brain that work to lay down a memory. What we've learned from the neurobiology of trauma research is that the memories of traumatic events are stored in a very disorganized way. When a survivor sits down and tries to explain to either responding officer or detective what happened in the assault, and it starts coming out in this bits and pieces fragmented way of they start one thing, but then they stop abruptly, and then they start talking about something else, or they start explaining it very generally, and then they start throwing in random details, it can be very confusing for law enforcement. And a lot of law enforcement, based on other training they've had, will look at that and say, this looks suspicious to me, because it seems like they're making it up as they're going along. They're not making it up as they're going along. They're having difficulty recalling the different pieces of the assault because of the way the trauma of the assault affected the way the memory is laid down. So for law enforcement, they see this completely disorganized, discombobulated presentation, and they say, I'm not believing this. This seems made up to me. What they're really seeing is evidence of trauma. What they're really seeing is how trauma impacts memory formation and then memory recall. So I think it's...
That is a real situation, and way too often. I mean, we have all heard it. You've all heard, you know, where law enforcement is not believing a story. You know, it's like, and someone has just gone through this trauma and is trying to, you know, talk to, you know, the trusted law enforcement, the ones that are on their side, and they're like going, I'm not buying what you're saying. It's like being in a nightmare.
Yeah, it really is hard, and I think it's really important to mention mentioned that, you know, documented in Department of Justice surveys and everything, that it's like less than 2% of people bringing forward false allegations. And in my long-term experience in this work, it's very, very few people. And if anything, typically survivors will recant the situation because they can't deal with the issues of disclosure and the pressures from their community and the perpetrator and everything around that. And I really appreciate her mentioning the flight, fight, or freeze response, because we keep hearing about the fight and the flight, but we don't hear about the freeze. And that is so very common in trauma survivors.
That's extremely common. That's actually, you know, it's a built-in defense mechanism. Right. It's hardwired into our DNA.
And it's
and then they internalize it as, you know, that they didn't do anything to,
except save your life.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and I think this is really... was a little bit scientific there with language that might have been somewhat inaccessible, but I think helpful. So for those of us who are survivors, if we had those kinds of reactions, and no one named that ever before, this is a way for us to understand why we reacted in the way that we did. Mm-hmm. And again, 786-5486. If you're just sitting there thinking, you know, I really do want to call, I really do, I want to say something about this, please do. 786-5486.
I really can't say enough about the mention of the physiological effects that trauma has on our brain. I feel like we are a very diagnosis-based society. We like to put labels on things, and we like to put a little box around it so that we feel comfortable with it. And when it comes to issues of trauma, we associate that with emotion, and we associate emotion with choice. This person is choosing to behave in this way or react in this way. This person is choosing to not remember what it is that happened to them. But if we actually label it and we look at the physiological effects that trauma has on the brain, I feel like people are more accepting of why trauma survivors react in the way that they do, whether it's that they aren't speaking, that they can't recall, or that they're speaking very rapidly and they're shifting in their seat and they're acting very erratically. And those things can be really easily misinterpreted as mental health concerns or alcohol and other drug issues. Mm-hmm. There's always the assumption that this person was under the influence of something, when in reality, it's the physiological effect of the trauma that they've just experienced.
Yeah, they are under the influence of their own bodies.
Body chemistry. Yeah, absolutely.
All of us have had something in our lives where we have had a flood of these kinds of hormones, and it's amazing. I mean, it is.
It's overwhelming.
It's overwhelming. It is like a drug. It is a drug. It's just a natural one that your body produces. Mm-hmm. Which is kind of amazing, and it's terrific that this was put together for law enforcement, because as they said, you know, when interrogating victims of this kind of trauma, some of the things that they're hearing, sometimes their other training in dealing with interrogating criminals, their red flags are going off. They're going, wait a second, this sounds like you're making
this story doesn't add up.
And that's what I'd really like, you know, for us to keep, as a society, to keep coming from a place of looking to believe survivor. What would happen if we believe versus Dr. Davis Lysak? I always say his name wrong. He's a really prominent person dealing with the issues of sexual assault. And he's talked about, he developed the video Undetected Rapist that we use in our educational programs. And he also talks about how you have to come from a place of investigating these assaults like you do other crimes. You investigate the alleged criminal and not the alleged victim. And so much law enforcement has been trained to then see if this is a credible deal rather than start from the place of believing and not having to investigate the survivor coming forward to see if this is a credible situation, but look to investigate the perpetrator, and that will help you build your case. But if you get stuck in this place, you're not even going to get over here very far.
Absolutely.
You know?
It is 4 minutes after 9. This is KHUM, Cutton, Eureka, Arcata, and Blue Lake. And stream it on the web at KHUM.com. It's our Stop the Violence, Start the Healing campaign roundtable discussion dealing with sexualized violence in Humboldt County. And it looks like we've got someone who wants to get in on the conversation. So let's go to the phone. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello, Hello, this is Douglas from Freshwater. And I, thank you, wonderful discussion.
Thank you.
And I just looked up in the dictionary the word rape, and it says plunder, pillage, abduction, and from the root from the Latin rapier, meaning to seize. And when I think of rape, I think of it as like all the. I mean, when we cut down a tree and the little birds are driven from their nest, and the animals, like all the animals that are like little cows, they start out playing, and then it's like we rape them of their innocence and their lives. At least that's how I think of it, and I wonder if it's really ever possible to end like our own, the human suffering, our that we especially men perpetrate. Can human suffering end as long as we're also as long as humans are also doing these things to nature? So.
I think we grow as a species. I mean, that's at least I hope we do. If we don't, then there's no hope. But we do seem to have grown in the past several thousand years, and hopefully we can grow a little faster than that.
But I think that the point is well made in terms of that encapsulated behavior that is the culture of aggression. It is that taking, that seizing, that using, that exploiting.
That entitlement,
the right to do so. And so there is that connection. And I think what happens is that we can only focus on a certain kind of suffering, and then we kind of measure that suffering. But when we really look at it, it's a sea of suffering. And it's human-generated. It can be human-stopped. Because it is always a choice whether we're going to aggress or act in a violent way. It's always a choice, even if it doesn't feel like a choice in the moment, because of the flood of chemicals, the hormones that we were just talking about. That and we tell ourselves these stories in our mind about how this we have the right to do this, or that this person has violated us in a certain way, and so that we get to aggress back, and that we are entitled, and that we have certain rights to take things, whether it's on a small scale or on a big scale. So thank you, caller. That was a really
you're welcome. Thank you for talking about this.
You bet. Thanks for calling. We appreciate that. And I'd like to invite anyone else who has a question or a comment to call in. We've got less than an hour to go. The number is 786-KHUM. That's 786-5486. And anyway, the overarching topic is dealing with sexualized violence in Humboldt County. But
we should remind you that if you call, hang on there, because there's no screeners, no people waiting your call.
Right.
There's just Cliff noticing and us noticing whether the button is lighting up. So
right.
Hang in there.
We don't have a ringer, because otherwise you'd hear it ringing.
Right.
This is not a telethon or anything.
786-5486. Please join our conversation.
Absolutely. And one of the... interesting things, and you hear this all the time. You hear this often from friends of victims of violence, and it's like, well, why didn't you do this? There are certain logical things that seem very logical when you are, stepping back from this situation. You're not in this life-threatening situation. Why didn't you just run? Why didn't you... make a phone call. Why didn't you do this? Why didn't you do that? And again, it's a lot of that goes back to the physiological flood that kind of logic is very hard to draw upon when your body is being flooded with all kinds of very basic instincts at this point.
And that's the thing too, because mostly people are sexually assaulted by someone that they know or love and care about, the shock of the violation is so mind-bending for a person, you
right.
know,
you actually, to you get actually, them. There's part of you that says, I don't believe this.
Exactly. Exactly. And so there is even a desire to believe maybe what the predator is saying to you about what's happening. So then there's all this state of confusion about it. And I think that also, you know, even for allies and support people, it can be challenging to own that this could happen to someone you care about, someone that is close to you, and by someone that you know, then it starts challenging how we trusting our own selves and how we view the world and then how we move through the world, you know. And that doesn't feel comfortable. That feels very uncomfortable. So we're going to naturally want to push it away or deny it or avoid it in some kind of way. So if people around the survivor are experiencing that, let's then think about how it is for the survivor to experience
Oh, absolutely.
That.
I
mean,
because as the survivor, you're saying, why didn't I? Why, you know, I should have, I could, you know, and you keep replaying it over and over again. I could have done this, I could have done that. So you're not, the people around aren't saying anything that the survivor hasn't already said to herself or himself. So,
right.
That this video addresses that specific thing. There's about a minute of video. I'd like to play it. It talks about that exact thing that we're
and it will only be audio for those of us in the listening audience.
Right. You can visualize someone talking. But it's the audio that actually counts.
One of the things that happens for many survivors during a sexual assault is that the neural mechanisms of rational, logical thought, they just don't function properly. I often explain this as trying to drive over a flooded road. So if there's been a very, very high release of hormones in the victim's body, the neural mechanisms, the roads that say, if this, then do that, you can't travel the road because it's flooded with hormones. You can't drive across a flooded road, it's flooded. So if a victim, you know, later on might remember, oh my gosh, there was a phone in the room, I could have done this, I could have tried to call for help or do something. At the time of the assault, they can't think that way. The idea that they would see a phone, go, oh, I could call for help, doesn't work. The road is flooded. The road of rational thought doesn't work under very, very high levels of stress hormones. And that can be very difficult for survivors later on when the road isn't flooded and the hormone levels come down and they go, oh my gosh, I coulda, woulda, shoulda done this. And unfortunately, so many times family and friends say, coulda, woulda, shoulda done this. And then law enforcement, doctors, nurses say, coulda, woulda, shoulda done this too.
Yeah, so that's the... it's awesome actually to see this, you know, kind of stuff being put forward for law enforcement to see that also, because you know it's those, you know, they're often asked the same questions. Why didn't you do that?
Right, exactly. And I think that's the other thing that's really been helpful in this research is that they have done research with first responders who are conditioned and trained to deal with crisis situations. But then when they're impacted by the situation, then when they're interviewed and trying to gather more information about it, they're experiencing the same kind of way. They're trained, like reflex reaction is interrupted by the trauma experience. And I think that that has even been more helpful for law enforcement to see, even from their discipline, that they can be impacted by this traumatic event and the hormones and everything that are released. And they're trained to respond in a certain way.
Yeah, and I was in a training once that was law enforcement based. It was actually directed to law enforcement. And to be honest with you, I can't recall anything else about this training other than it was a law enforcement officer doing the talking. And he said that one of the most important things he learned in investigating any crime when talking to a survivor or a victim was that you don't use the word why. Why implies blame. If I ask you, Cliff, why did you get in that car, as opposed to what led to you getting in the car? What is more of an open-ended question? Which one implies blame and which one doesn't? And I think that's important that we're aware of our language, not only when we're as professionals working with survivors, but as friends and family members, that it is natural for us to question these things because we don't want this to have happened to somebody we love and care about. So we're trying to grasp at straws to understand it ourselves. So we start asking these questions. Why did you do this? And why didn't you do that? And that implies that there was a choice there.
And it feels like an attack.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And that led to so many of us not reporting
when I was hitchhiking in the Bay Area in San Francisco, and I just knew in the 70s, and I just knew there was no way that I could defend that I was hitchhiking. I actually, yeah, so that's, I never reported that. There was no way to really defend that action at that time.
And that's why we talked earlier this week with Paula Arrowsmith-Jones about sexualized violence and violence in general in the trim scene. Because, you know, a lot of people make a little bit of extra money. A lot of college students make a little extra money, you know, doing trimming this time of year. And while I guess I think the vast majority goes just fine, there are times where, you know, you've got the setup where it's almost perfect for this. It's mm-hmm. it's an illegal mm-hmm. activity. It's out in mm-hmm. the middle of nowhere.
You're isolated. Have no transportation.
You have no transportation. It's isolated. And
what are you doing out there?
And someone who is sexually assaulted, they were doing something illegal.
Right.
Mm-hmm. They feel very, it's very unlikely they'll report it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because then the pressure would be that they be shining a light on the illegal activity. Mm-hmm. What all they're wanting to shine a light on is that somebody chose to do violence on them. They don't want to shine mm-hmm. the light on any of that. They want to be a member of that community held in good standing. And anybody snitching on somebody and their livelihood, they're going to be shunned by that community, if not more. And so that does challenge them to not speak a word about it.
Right,
and so, you know that the predator is going to be naming all that.
Absolutely. So if hitchhiking is too taboo to talk about, imagine, you know, working on trimming.
Or mm-hmm. prostitution.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we
absolutely.
See
right.
issues
right.
with that all the time.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And what I really love about the North Coast Rape Crisis Team, many things, but what I really love is that folks can call you. And there is no coercion or even encouragement to report. If somebody doesn't want to do that, they don't have to do that. If they want to know what that might look like or what that might involve, then information is given about that. But there is, you call and you get the support and help you need and not anything beyond that.
So. Yeah, it's not our place to judge what's right or wrong for you in your life. You're the best judge of that, and we're going to listen and give you information and support you in whatever way you want to do, where you want to go. Because we know that the system is not perfect, and it doesn't always work for people, and sometimes it really disappoints people. And so we need to be real about that. And
I think that's important.
And there are safety issues and concern,
yeah.
too.
That, I think that's that, very important to mention that, yeah, that you don't encourage people one way or the other yeah. with regard to reporting or any of that. You're really there to help, you know, the person who has gone through this trauma.
Right.
No matter
right.
when
no matter
it what. Happened. Mm-hmm.
And that's another important thing, no matter when it happened, because there are people, especially listening today to this, where you may have had something happen to you, you know, 10, 20, 60 years ago, and it has been very well boxed away. And mm-hmm. You know, hearing a conversation like this could absolutely kind of open that box a little bit and let some of these feelings out. And, you know, this organization, you know, North Coast Rape Crisis, is there to help you through something that happened a million years ago or a few minutes ago.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
Because everybody needs to take their own time in their healing.
Absolutely.
And find their
There's
voice.
No time limit.
No, there isn't.
There's
there
no
isn't.
Statute of limitations when it comes to dealing with your trauma.
No. There isn't.
It's our 19th Stop the Violence, Start the Healing campaign. We've got to take a quick break, let our sponsor say a few words, and we will continue on this dialogue. And I would like to remind you that this is an open conversation with the entire community. If you'd like to join in, ask a question, make a comment, the number 786-KHUM, that's 786-5486. You don't need to give your name. It's 22 minutes after 9. You've got it on KHUM. Our Stop the Violence, Start the Healing campaign continues. We are dealing with sexualized violence in Humboldt County. We should probably go around the room and introduce ourselves again. I'm Cliff. And, of course, Sherry Johnson, my co-host for the past 19 years.
Yes.
Say hi.
I'm here and donut-filled.
Yes, that is one of the guilty pleasures. Every year we get a big plate full of donuts.
The result of 19 years of donuts.
Right.
And to my left is...
I'm Kim Schneider. I'm with the District Attorney Victim Witness Program and the Child Abuse Services Team.
And I'm Marianne Hayes Mariani with the North Coast Rape Crisis Team.
And thank you all. And while we were in the break, we were talking about what we were going to discuss next. And Kim, you've got something that I know that you wanted to talk about.
Yeah, so we touched upon the services of North Coast Rape Crisis Team just briefly and how survivors are able to access those services, whether or not they choose to engage with law enforcement, at what point the incident had occurred, etc. It's a little bit different for the services that we offer. Obviously, we're a component of the District Attorney's Office, sure. Victim Witnesses, and so much of what we do is attached to crimes that have been reported and are being forwarded to the District Attorney's Office. For DA Victim Witness, a lot of what we do is providing support to survivors and victims of violent crime. I work with survivors of sexual assault and child abuse victims as well. Those services vary based on what the family needs, what kind of crime has been committed, what choices the District Attorney's Office is making and moving forward with being able to prosecute the case. But ultimately, it's based on the fact that a report of a crime having occurred has been made, and then the District Attorney's Office has been made aware of it, and it's been forwarded to our office to provide service to the family or the survivors. We are the gateway to the Victims' Compensation Fund. The Victims' Compensation Fund can provide financial support to survivors and victims of violent crimes. We are not able to address property crimes, so if your car was broken into, I apologize, but that's not something we're able to address. We can assist potentially with counseling services, reimbursement for medical costs incurred due to an assault or a violent crime. If the victim did not survive the crime, we can assist with funeral burial costs and any costs associated with that particular issue. We can also assist with relocation in circumstances where the survivor is still in danger of being assaulted or being harmed due to having reported the crime, or maybe the suspect is no longer in custody. So those are different financial aspects that we can assist with. It does require that we do a good amount of paperwork, and that goes to our claims department and then to the board for approval. So I'm only there to assist with the paperwork. I don't get to make the decisions, unfortunately. We will also keep families and survivors apprised of what's going on throughout the court process. It's not a user-friendly system. It's difficult to navigate, and especially if you're not an attorney, which I am not, it's still difficult sometimes for me to navigate. So I am there to keep families informed of what's going on, what the next steps are going to be, what their participation is going to look like if necessary in the process. We accompany them to court, advocate for them with the DA's office, law enforcement. But my actual role with Victim Witness is also part of the Child Abuse Services Team. The Child Abuse Services Team, also known as CAST, is a multidisciplinary team that's comprised of the District Attorney's Office, Department of Health and Human Services, particularly Child Welfare Services, North Coast Rape Crisis Team, if there is sexualized violence involved, County Mental Health to provide emotional support to survivors, and then DA Victim Witness. The Child Abuse Services Team is in place to assist with the investigation of child abuse. So when a report of child abuse comes in to any law enforcement agency locally, our MOU indicates that they would partner with us to interview the victim as opposed to law enforcement interviewing the victim. Historically, law enforcement would be the one interviewing the survivor, which can be incredibly challenging. Obviously, talking to a police officer isn't always the most comfortable of settings. And although they are trained to interview and to, as Cliff put it before, interrogate, interrogation is something that happens with the suspect. It shouldn't be something that happens with a survivor. So we have modified the process so that it's a more trauma-informed process for the survivor and their family. So we will have a trained child forensic interviewer who is a part of Child Welfare Services conduct the interview. The interview is conducted in a way that it's recorded so that hopefully the child survivor only has to tell their story once, as opposed to having to go through all these different systems and share their story repeatedly, which can be incredibly challenging. It's difficult for prosecution because there's a potential for things to be forgotten or left out or discrepancies in stories because, as we heard, what we remember might change as we get further and further away from the trauma.
And is the child interviewed by all of those people or just one person?
Just one person. The child will be interviewed in a room alone with the child forensic interviewer. We have three fabulous child forensic interviewers right now from Child Welfare Services. They do an amazing job. They are trained through the National Children's Alliance, which is the accrediting agency for all child advocacy centers in the United States. So each of them go through a rigorous training to be able to conduct these interviews. It's a very specialized part of their job. All three of them right now are also supervisors at Child Welfare Services. So they've got a full plate, but they're all very dedicated to CAST and to going through this process.
And what would be the youngest age of a child who would be considered a credible witness?
It varies based on verbal ability, but typically we would say 3 years old if they're a verbal three-year-old. It can be challenging. With the younger kiddos, we do tend to do what we would call an extended forensic interview. So the first interaction that they would have with the forensic interviewer would just be a get to know you. You know, they know that now this is a safe place, and this is a place that we talk about things that might have happened, and that whoever's going to be talking to them is going to be talking to them again. The second part of the interview process, depending on what law enforcement wants to do, because it is law enforcement driven, it is based on their investigative process, is typically the following day after the first interview. And so they're a little accustomed to what the interview process looks like and who they're going to be talking to. And then they'll come back in, and that's when they get into the meat of what might have actually occurred. And it's really driven by the child at that point. If the child is ready to disclose and wants to share, then that's perfectly fine. And if they weren't in a space to share at that point, we don't see that as a failed interview. They were given the opportunity, and we can always revisit it when they are ready.
And, you know, one thing that you talked about was, you know, verbal skills. And a young child's verbal skills and ability to describe what happened, not necessarily as articulate as an adult. And so I guess you guys have to be really listening for clues as to what they mean by something. You know, we could, you know, say I got a boo-boo, or, you know, or something, some kind of euphemism that they may use that you don't know what it really means. How do
and
you
that's
draw
what's
that
really
out?
Important about the training that they receive,
right,
is about developmental issues regarding different ages of children and how they might formulate that and how to question in an interview versus interrogation kind of way of what their verbiage is about things, what their language is, and really talk about it. And it's really a child-friendly environment versus if any of us have been at law enforcement, it's pretty sterile.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Not really inviting.
No teddy bears.
Yeah.
No.
And so they really have developed a very inviting, as inviting as something like that can be, but yeah, it's definitely more user-friendly than other institutions are. And I also want to say is, like, it does cut down the interviews that happen, but that doesn't change that the child still may need to testify in court, because sometimes that gets confused in this.
Yeah, thank you for mentioning that, because I think that's a large misconception on a lot of people's parts, that if my child participates in this interview, they're not going to have to participate in prosecution, and that is not necessarily the case.
And we do know, though, that how the adults respond to the traumatic event is as important and even maybe more important than what the event was.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that's part of why this service has been so vital and important to the youth in our community, is its goal is to assist prosecution, but it also is a whole community response, because we know these cases are challenging. And many of the cases, the DA may not feel like there's enough information to move forward, but it has engaged a systems where it's advocates and mental health services and all that. So even if it isn't a strong enough case to move forward in the system, there's intervention services that are available to the family, and that's really important.
Yeah, it's everybody coming to the table to address the issue of child abuse,
mm-hmm,
and how we are going to move forward in addressing those concerns in our community. And it's a wonderful group of people that comes to the table. We have an advisory board, and that's a public meeting. It's monthly, the second Tuesday of every month. So if you're interested in it and you want to hear more about what the CAST team does, then you're more than welcome to attend.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And I think, you know, that can make a difference. How that intervention unfolds can make a difference in how the child integrates that experience and may not necessarily be permanently damaged in the way that might have been the case prior to the advent of something like that.
Absolutely.
And I really, the other really great program that North Coast Rape Crisis Team has sponsored, conducted for the last 35 years, I don't know, sexual assault prevention program in the schools.
That's a wonderful program.
Yeah. We do age-appropriate curriculum from the little toddlers to adults in the universities and everywhere. And it's age-appropriate and it's an engaging curriculum. And I think that it again promotes dialogue because we try to talk to the young people. We do it with dolls and kind of a puppet theater, but engage the youth in it. And it isn't a scary situation. It's kind of a safety situation, mm-hmm. talking about problem-solving safety situations and how the rules of their family around that, if they have safe words, if they have safe people that they talk to. And it's I think it's really important. And as we go up in the ages of the youth, we talk about different things like sexual harassment in junior high. That's when all that stuff gets really, really prevalent. And to assist them in having language about that and knowing the resources around that is really important. And
yeah.
promoting that dialogue within each other, you know, to talk about it.
Yeah.
And the same as, you know, high schoolers and rape prevention and talking about intimate partner violence and just... Because we live in a rape culture, we have to talk about this with our youth and our children. And
yeah, absolutely.
And many years ago, I was a facilitator, and it was for like a really little kid's class, maybe first grade or second grade. And so we were doing role plays, and then there's a talk time afterwards.
Yeah.
And one little girl came up to me and basically disclosed, and then she brought three of her friends. Because they all had been keeping this secret.
Mm-hmm.
And it was
mm-hmm.
like, oh, no, here we go. But that was an immediate response and an immediate intervention in that sense of that was an opportunity that little girl and her friends who were all keeping that secret would never have. I would hope that would have unfolded in a different way in another time, but that's... Because of that program, that's what was able to happen.
And I think it's
important to talk about, because in our school, we are mandated reporters in the school. On our crisis line and our intervention services, we are not mandated reporters. So somebody can, and often we have youth that call our crisis line after a presentation and say, you people said this. I don't know. Was this sexual assault? And so on the hotline, we wouldn't be a mandate reporter, but in the schools, we are. And for that reason, I remember doing in classroom that, and sometimes teachers mention to us a student that they might have some concerns about. And this teacher mentioned a young boy, I think it was in the fourth grade, in one of the outlying areas. And, she said she really feels like something was going on for him. And so he was really engaged in the curriculum. And then he participated in talk time. And one of the things he seemed like he was really building his self-esteem. And he would say certain things about himself. Well, I can do that. And that's because I can and I'm special. And I asked him, so, wow, it's really good to hear that you feel so special and that you know that about yourself. How is it you know that about yourself? And he points to the teacher, which she said, I've only had him for like 4 months, but I know something's going on. And it's one of those families that move from area to area when something comes to light, they're booking out of there. But what was so gratifying to me is for that teacher to see and for that youth to, that life preserver that got put out to him was something he grabbed hold of and build on his resiliency and was giving him tools to deal with the life situation, even though he made it clear to us that he was not going to disclose anything. But here were the tools that certain people had given him to manage his life.
That's what's so important about this. Both my boys grew up in this area and have had visits from you guys at their schools. And, every once in a while you have some parents that are resistant to have, this outside organization talking about things that are kind of sensitive mm-hmm. to their kids. Mm-hmm. But as you mentioned, you do it in age-appropriate ways in the various different age groups and all the way to the very young. But I think the very important thing is that it is an outside person outside of the family, because unfortunately, sometimes within that loving family can be some serious problems. Mm-hmm. And, you know, children don't have this big life experience to draw from as far as what is appropriate. Mm-hmm. They're learning mm-hmm. what's appropriate in their household. So it's, you know, to hear it from an outside source that maybe this is not appropriate.
Right, right.
It can be a really big thing that you can do.
Huge, yeah. Huge.
I've had a lot of adult survivors of child sexual abuse come to me and say that what led to them disclosing or what led to them sharing was a presentation in the school, whether it be North Coast Rape Crisis Team or a simple discussion about sexual education, especially because a lot of times these kids are isolated. Mm-hmm. We live in a very geographically isolated community.
Yes,
we have
we
to address the demographic that we're serving. And the reality is that we are very isolated. And a lot of kids can be extremely isolated, being homeschooled, being kept up on the hill or whatever that looks like. And so if you're completely isolated and the only experience you've had is that this sexualized violence is normalized, that this mm-hmm. is okay, mm-hmm. and then all of a sudden you're in a sex ed class or rape crisis comes to talk to you and you realize maybe what's happening to me isn't normal. Maybe what's mm-hmm. happening to me isn't okay. Mm-hmm. And now this is where I get to say that this isn't okay.
Right. It's because that lack of frame of reference is so, mm-hmm. that's why it's so important. To you know, get that information out to kids at a young age, because if they're not getting the proper frame of reference at home, mm-hmm. where else are they going to get it?
Right, right.
Yeah. All right, we've got to take a quick break. We do have someone calling. I'm going to take that call during the break, and hopefully we'll get them on the air in just a bit. You got it on KHUM. And our Stop the Violence, Start the Healing campaign continues. You've got it on KHUM. And we're dealing with sexualized violence here in Humboldt County. We've got about 20 minutes left before we wrap this up, and we've got a couple of phone calls. So we'll take our first one right now. Hi, you're on the air.
Is that me?
That is you.
Oh, okay, great. Yeah, so I was talking to Cliff during the break and saying thanks, first of all, for doing all this. But I'm a firm believer in preventing violence. Before it happened.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking that, you know, a perpetrator's not going to call in and go, geez, I think I feel like I want to victimize someone. What are some tools that a potential perpetrator who might be listening to this can do to prevent them from doing the crime in the first place?
Really, really important question. And again, you know, perpetrators aren't monsters with, you know, somebody has three eyes. Well, you know, they're not distorted physically. They're regular people. Many of them, not all, some of them were victimized as children. So they learned that they would rather be a victimizer than a victim because they saw that and they experienced that. They need to talk to somebody they trust. And a lot of men have a hard time talking to other men. And this would apply to anybody, any gender. But they need to talk to somebody. They need to reach out to somebody. Because that very act can be the thing that stops them from doing the thing that they feel compelled to do. They need a pause. They need a moment to reflect on the consequences of that action. Because that will change everybody's lives. If they go ahead and victimize.
And there are organizations that do help with that. It's like we have talked with the organization MEND.
MEND WEND. Men and women WEND. Experiencing non-abusive directions.
And that is mandated for people who do perpetrate domestic violence. However, it is open to anyone who would like help. And, you know, it's, you know, there are plenty of perpetrators of violence who hate themselves for doing it.
And Nariman Associates is another resource because they have a offenders treatment program, but they also work with survivors so they can work with that dual issue of mm-hmm. someone having been victimized and then choosing to
right.
Do perpetration.
And it's important to note also that the majority of people who are abused do not become abusers,
mm-hmm.
but the majority of people who are abusers were abused.
Mm-hmm.
So
it's kind of confusing.
Yes, caller?
Am I still on the air?
You are.
Yes, you are.
I would like to request that as you guys do these sessions, you know, on the air, that throughout them you throw that out there so that potential perpetrators hear their options over and over.
Yeah, I try to interject that it's always a choice, and that we have the power, and that's, you know, you feel so powerless in this dynamic where everybody is acting on reactions that are deeply conditioned. But if we can take that breath, we can take that pause, we can make a different choice. And I know, having somebody who was close to me who was molested as a boy, who called me late at night and had coupled up with a woman with four children, and he was wanting to molest. And we were able to talk this through. He had all of those persuasive arguments that I kept saying, a child cannot say yes. A child cannot say yes. You didn't say yes. So I was able to get him to see a really well-known therapist. She's passed on now, who worked with a lot of children who were molested, and he did not molest.
Good.
But he reached out and he got help.
Yeah, I would think that in general they don't want to do it. They just need help and tools to prevent them from doing it
and to make a different choice.
Yeah.
Thanks for calling. What a great point.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Alrighty. And I do believe we have another person who wants to get in on the conversation, so we will go to line two. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
So first, I would like to say, well, a year ago, we had a situation where my daughter was sexually assaulted.
I'm sorry
to
hear that.
So bear with me. I do get emotional. Baca and victim witness were amazing. I don't know how we would have walked through that first period of time without them. I called in to comment on the misconception of thinking you won't have to testify with a cast interview. My daughter was told she wouldn't have to, with our family standing there, when they were explaining what the cast was, which I already knew because I've worked with kids in the county and different things. So I already knew what a cast interview was, but she didn't. So they were explaining it. And she was told she wouldn't have to. And then later, when we thought that the person that raped her was not going to plead guilty, they told her she would have to testify, which did not end up happening. So I don't think it's just a misconception. I feel like there's sometimes a disconnect in who is explaining something, the way it's being explained. So that was what I was calling in for. There was definitely no misconception on our part. That was what she was told. Which, again, didn't end up being what happened. He did plead guilty. So,
well, I'm happy I'm not trying to cut you off. What was that?
Oh, no, it's okay.
Well, I'm happy that ultimately it ended in him pleading guilty and her not having to go through that incredibly re-traumatizing process. And I really appreciate you calling and making mention of this, because I do think that these things do get miscommunicated on multiple levels, because it's a multidisciplinary team. We have a lot of different players at the table, and we have a lot of different people with different levels of understanding of what our criminal justice system looks like and whether or not a victim is going to have to testify. So I'm not sure at what level your daughter was informed of that, whether it was with law enforcement or with our interview specialist or
the DA's office.
With the DA's office.
Yes.
Well, I am incredibly sorry that happened, because we are able to move forward with our healing based on the information that's given to us. And to then all of a sudden have that foundation pulled out from underneath of us and told that, no, you are going to have to do this incredibly difficult thing is unbelievably challenging. So I am very sorry that that happened. And I really do appreciate you calling and making sure that that is acknowledged, because I think a lot of families are in positions such as yours locally and out of the area where that is the understanding, or that's what's communicated to them. And the reality is that prosecution is difficult, and it's almost nearly impossible for a lot of cases without survivor or victim testimony.
Right.
And so we kind of have this reassurance from people that's false, that that's not something they're going to have to do because we've set up this wonderful process. But the reality is the wonderful process is just in lieu of law enforcement interviewing the survivor. It's to mitigate the trauma experienced throughout that process, but not necessarily to replace testimony. Yeah.
Right, right.
And your disclosure of this is really helpful to us to renew our efforts in training all the members of our various disciplines to be really accurate about the information we're sharing. So I really appreciate you stating that.
Right. It was very, she was very, you know, when they said that to her, she just immediately went into a panic attack.
And, of course.
You know, so it was pretty rough. But, I mean, it was, like I said, it kind of took care of itself. I had told them at that point, you know, we did the cast, and then she had also done, you know, the hospital, the exam. And I told them, amongst other evidence we knew they had, that they had enough, that no matter what, she wasn't going to be testifying. So I put my foot down with that, not to step in the middle of, you know, or try to, I just knew personally.
You're being her parent.
Right, that, and I knew that they had enough.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
And we'd already been through enough. We had, you know, what happened, and then we, law enforcement was at my house. It happened at my house with someone in my house. It was about 10 minutes to 12 in the afternoon when we were finishing up with law enforcement, and it took until 5:45 to get her scheduled for the rape kit. To have the rape kit and all, you know, the exam at the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
So she sat in vomit and, you know, whatever else until that time. So those are the two things that we went through with the whole process that were that part more upsetting than anything. I've often thought throughout the year, you know, how can I help with that? And it just has been kind of on the back burner with getting our lives back together.
Mm-hmm.
But for anyone to have to wait, what would that be? Almost 6 hours. We were scheduled at 5:45 to be at the hospital. And told not to shower, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And so forth, you know, so
very,
as far
very
as being
difficult.
Able to, it was, as mm-hmm. far as, you know, saying, hey, this was our experience and what happened, and, you know, this is what could be. Obviously, there was some kind of something there. We were told there was no one available to do the exam, and found out later that not everyone had been called. The medical assistant that she usually saw at Eureka Peds was available and could have done it at about 12:30.
Oh.
So being able to go through, you know, and have everything utilized or everyone called to try to make that easier.
Right.
And I don't know how you make that easier, but you, I'm sure you understand what I'm saying.
Yeah.
We do. Just seemed like there was kind of a disconnect somewhere to where it was just not.
Well, it's horrible on top of horrible.
Right.
Yeah, drama on trauma.
Yeah.
The officer was so angry, and, you know, he's apologizing, and it was pretty awful to have to sit there and, you know that, because she kept asking me to shower, and it was just pretty awful. But without going into the rest of that, those are the things that I wanted to call in about. And again, I victim witness services, they were so attentive, and Baca was and still are very supportive. They're another part of our family now.
That's Bikers Against Child Abuse, for anybody who doesn't know that about that organization.
Absolutely.
And they are very supportive. And a lot of people I don't think really, I mean, I think they're getting more recognition, but a lot of people didn't know. I knew to call them because I had worked with a child that had their services. So they were one of the first people that I called. And my daughter, they were very supportive of my daughter. And I think she felt, she wouldn't have went to court. She went for his sentencing. Wow. She wouldn't have went if they hadn't sat with her.
Right.
So, anyway, that's what I wanted to call in about.
Well,
and thank you for.
Yeah. Very sorry for everything you had to go through, and very appreciative of you taking the time to share with not only us but the entire community of Humboldt.
You've helped lots of people today.
Thank you much.
Thank you. All right. Bye bye.
Bye. That was a terrific share. Ah, man. So, you know, before we wrap this up, you know, one thing that, you know, that she brought up that is, you know, an unfortunate thing is, you know, is the trauma on top of the trauma.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is why, unfortunately, so many people who go through, you know, some kind of sexual assault don't go through that process.
Mm-hmm.
Because although it has, over the years, been made so much better than it was, I mean, it was a terrible process where the victim was pretty much, you know, put on trial. While a lot of things like that have changed, it's still a traumatic process. And it's, you know, as you heard right there, with all the best intentions, it was a terrible thing to go through.
And we're really, there's nothing more powerful than to hear people's stories and what folks have survived. And we wish your daughter and your family the best healing possible, and we will keep you in our thoughts.
And we're out of time. So
I do want to say that there's a event today on tonight at 6:45 in the Great Hall above the new dorms at Humboldt State University. That's called the Great Hall, the Consent Project. And it's about learning how to say enthusiastically, yes, I want to have sex. So I encourage anybody who's interested in learning those skills to please attend this evening's event at the HSU campus.
Fantastic. And I'd just like to go around the room, everyone give them their final thoughts. And
we'll start with Marianne.
So I really appreciate that mom calling. And I think that's part of what we really need to know and reiterate is, you know, it's a community response, and parents and everyone are impacted by this. And to get whatever resources work for you, and to name things that don't, because that's how we improve our services. And I really appreciate your courage in naming that. I want everybody to recognize that we have, like, our prevention services and our intervention services, and we co-advocate with all advocacy organizations, and we're available every moment of every day to talk to survivors and their loved ones. Our number is 707-445-2881. Please call if you need support.
Thank you so much. Kim?
Well, I want to kind of reiterate what Marianne said and how important it is that we do have those things reflected back to us so that change can be made, so that we know what we're falling short on and what we need to be focusing on, so that families are receiving the most effective services possible. And that obviously was a very difficult situation with challenges that shouldn't have been there, just adding to that existing trauma. So thank you so much for calling and sharing that. Victim Witness is available to provide assistance to survivors or victims of crime. You're more than welcome to call us. We can be reached at 707-445-7417. And I just want to appreciate everyone for inviting me to be here, and thank you.
You bet.
And there is on the KHEM website a resource guide. So if you didn't get the numbers, you can get the numbers from going to the resource guide, both in English and in Espanol.
And the English one is an interactive guide, so it'll take you right to where you want. It'll ask you questions. You answer this, it takes you to the next place.
And then thank you, Marianne, so much. Thank you, Kim, so much, taking time to be here and to really share the wealth of experience and knowledge that you have. And we do know that we have a new district attorney coming in, Maggie Fleming, and this will be something that we will have her listen to, ask her to listen to. And you know, when we know that we can make change, we can make change, and we can only try to do better. So we want to talk a little bit really quickly about next week and the Healing Breakfast concluding on Friday, November 21st
right,
at the Eureka Women's Club.
Next week we're dealing with youth, who are vulnerable and people who can help. We're going to be starting off with Rochelle Trottenberg. And what does that large acronym
Humboldt
stand
County
for?
Humboldt County Transitional Age Youth Collaborative.
Wow.
HCTACY.
Fantastic. Yeah, we'll be having folks in from Spare Change and Raven. It's going to be a very good week. And these are all really wonderful groups who do really terrific things in our community with youth. And the Healing Breakfast, of course, is a week from today. That's going to be from 8 until 10. It's at the Women's Club there on J Street in Eureka. And it's free and open to the public. There'll be delicious signature coffee, the Cahill blend. There'll be wonderful pastries from Velatini Baking Company.
Music.
Yes, music from our very own Lindsay Battle. And resources from so many wonderful organizations that'll be just circling the room.
And Maggie Fleming will be our keynote speaker.
That is right. Our incoming DA, Maggie Fleming, will be our keynote speaker, and she'll also stick around and be part of our panel as well.
And we'll be doing a drawing for a quilt at the Healing Breakfast, made by none other than the participants from last year's Healing Breakfast and
wonderful.
Pulled together by Oceana Madrone.
That is just wonderful. And we've got to acknowledge Sun Valley Floral Farms, who always come through with these beautiful flower arrangements.
Amy
does the arrangement.
Sunflower yes, provides the flowers.
They provide the flowers. And Amy does the lovely arranging, and she does such a beautiful job. Of that. So,
and I can't appreciate Cliff and Sherry enough for the 19 years of community service this program has provided, because it really, it brings our community together to talk about these challenging issues. And I just really appreciate you opening that forum.
And I want to acknowledge and appreciate people who stick around and listen to the whole thing. Because we're, well, let's face it, there's a lot more pleasant things to be doing on a Friday than listening to people talking about a rather unpleasant subject.
So thank you to our dear listening audience.
Yes, we do appreciate that. And I am... intruding on Mike's time, so we've got to take a break.
He'll have a donut.
we'll drive him the sweets, and we will turn it over to Mike the Funk Prophet next. And as I say, next week it's going to be youth who are vulnerable and people who can help.